This episode of The Ready Room is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 180,000 titles for smartphone, tablet, and desktop. To get a free audiobook of your choice and support the network at the same time, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. And also by Enterprise in Space, an international program of the nonprofit National Space Society. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter. Visit enterpriseinspace.org.
Hi, this is Michael Dorn, Lieutenant Commander Worf from Next Generation and Deep Space Nine, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome to The Ready Room, show number 211, To Hoof or Not to Hoof. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me today is Larry Nemechek. This is going to be a different kind of Ready Room, as it's my first behind the mic in more than 8 months. The last time I recorded The Ready Room was August 20th, 2016, less than 2 weeks before my life was turned upside down by health issues. So, in my first episode back, Larry and I are going to chat about some of the big Star Trek stories that happened during my absence. For the first half of the show, we'll talk about what's probably the biggest, which is Star Trek Discovery. And in the second half, we'll talk about various events and experiences from the 50th anniversary year and moving into 2017. Before that, however, I'd like to share an explanation of what's been going on and why, after 6 years of podcasting consistently, I suddenly took a really long break. So please bear with me for a few minutes. Many of you already know this story from the Babel Conference, which is our listeners group on Facebook, or from my own Facebook page. But for those who don't, you have to roll back to September 4th of last year, and that's when I noticed some black dots in my vision. I didn't think too much of it, but the next morning, as I was walking up the final stretch to my office, my vision became very cloudy. It was really weird. I thought there was just something in my eye, and I tried doing some drops and the usual stuff, but within a few hours, I had hundreds of black dots streaming in front of me. The problem was in my left eye, which already has an artificial lens that was implanted in 2014 after I had cataract surgery. If you're a longtime listener to The Ready Room or The Orb, or even Literary Treks, you know all about this because at the time I shared what was going on. So I have sort of a history with my left eye. I called my ophthalmologist and described what was happening, and he said it sounded like an emergency and to come to the clinic immediately. It turned out that I had a retinal detachment, which means that the retina is no longer attached to the wall of the eye, which is exactly what the name sounds like, but it's something you don't think about very much. But when it happens, it can actually lead to blindness. It has to be treated quite quickly. If the detachment tears towards the center of your eye, you will lose your vision. So I went to the clinic, and they felt that it could be repaired by laser surgery, which is done from outside the eye, right? Shooting a laser into your eye. So I had that procedure done that evening. It worked, but the problem resurfaced 2 weeks later in a different spot. They repaired that with lasers as well. But within 2 weeks, it happened again. Different spot. So at that point, it was clear that something was really wrong, and I was sent to KU University Hospital. They looked at my eye. They said, yes, you have another detachment. So I was hospitalized, and that's when the real saga began. I had a vitrectomy, which is a 2-hour surgical procedure, under the knife in which they remove all the liquid from your eye. They use lasers and cryo lasers, which are cold lasers, inside the eye to repair detachments and tears. Then they fill your eye with gas, and that takes 2 to 6 weeks to dissipate depending on the kind of gas they use. And I had both kinds over the course of my little saga here. So this vitrectomy worked. But once the gas was gone, my retina detached again in a different spot, and I had several tears around the detachment. Now, long story short, this happened 3 more times. So this went on and on and on. I was hospitalized 4 times altogether. I had 4 vitrectomies, and now my eye is filled entirely with silicone oil. That's there to hold the retina flat in the hopes that it will completely heal itself. I'll have surgery again later this year to remove the oil. It has to come out because it creates high pressure, and also it makes everything blurry, so I can't see very well right now. But hopefully, once that's done, everything will be repaired as best it can. I'm not going to get my normal vision back in full, but I should be able to see better than I do now. So hopefully everything will turn out well. I feel positive right now, which is why I'm back behind the microphone. So the journey isn't over, but I'm ready to get back behind the mic and try to resume a normal life. So I want to say thank you to all of you for your patience and your support. Thank you for sticking with the show, sticking with the network through all this. I'm only a small part of this network that I started more than 6 years ago, but I know that many of you do enjoy this show, as well as The Orb, our Deep Space Nine show, which I do with Matthew Rushing. So I'm looking forward to getting back to podcasting. I hope that you've been enjoying all the wonderful shows here on Trek FM that our hosts publish each day. I'm just really glad to once again be a part of those voices. So thank you very much for your support. All right, well, enough of that. You downloaded this to hear us talk about Star Trek, not eye surgery, but I did feel the need to explain what's been going on and to do so in a bit of detail. The last thing I really wanted to do was take such a long break, but I haven't been able to podcast. But I'm back now. Hopefully I will be able to stay back. I just wish we had 24th century medicine. That would make my life a whole lot easier. Okay, well, that's all I have to say about this, so let's head on into the ready room and talk to Larry. Larry, there's a thick layer of dust all over this ready room. Did someone forget to call the cleaning crew?
I thought we had the hollow Zumba in here working, but I guess Roomba, Zumba, what do we call them in the 21st century?
No, all the Roombas are occupied right now because Wesley is teaching them how to pick up chairs and fly them down the corridors.
I always wanted to see a Roomba Rumba, but, you know, maybe that's what they're doing. Yeah.
So I'm going to dust the desk off here. There's this weird thing in front of me called a microphone, apparently. I haven't seen one of these in a while.
Oh, well, you know what? Yours does look a little dusty. Fortunately, I've whipped in with mine that I've kept in slightly better shape. But my microphone is lonely to be here in the ready room with your microphone, Chris. It's been a long time. It feels like forever.
It does feel like forever. It was last August. And finally, I've got the mains back online. They're not at full capacity. They're not at 100% yet. It wasn't Scotty who worked on them. Otherwise, they would be perfect. But
of course, they're running.
And we're trying to get the microphone going again here a little bit.
It's good to be back sharing a mic with you on another Ready Room.
Absolutely. So let's talk about, not everything, of course, because that's not possible, but some of the big news that's happened in the world of Star Trek since I last podcasted here on the network last August.
Okay, Shunny. let's dig back through all that.
Let's go through it all. This is going to be a little bit of a different ready room because we're not going to do a feature discussion about an episode. We're just going to talk about some of these news topics. And Larry, the one, of course, we have to start with is the one everyone's talking about, Star Trek Discovery, which if things had gone as planned, we would have already been watching it for 4 months. And if things had gone as next planned, we would be getting ready to watch it maybe next week, but things are not going as planned. So where are we?
Now, wait a minute, Chris. How can we be talking about Discovery? Because it looks to me like half of the internet is melting down over the fact that there's no Discovery news. So how can we be talking about Discovery news if there's no Discovery news to be talking about? I know.
Yeah, there's nothing at all out there about Star Trek Discovery. That's why StarTrek.com has a dedicated Discovery section, because there's nothing to put there. They just thought, it's just a placeholder.
It's just an empty file. Hold on a second. I haven't looked at today's pads. Let me dust this off over here in the corner. And oh, why, look, there was a headline just today as we record this. Yes, I think...
You know, Larry, if we were actually on an episode of Star Trek The Next Generation, the doors would slide open right now, and someone carrying a stack of like 10 pads would walk in with the 10 news stories for today, because each pad would only be able to display one news item.
And if this was a Next Generation movie, somebody would walk in with the world's largest pad with all of them showing at once, which of course totally negates the reason for having a pad. Anyway, I'll never forget the first contact mega pad. It's like, well, what is the point of that? Yes.
That's the pad pro, Larry. That's the pad pro.
Oh, okay. Right. That was that other time when Steve Jobs wasn't running Apple in the 21st century.
Right. Didn't you notice Picard using the Starfleet pencil to write on it? He couldn't do that with the smaller pads, Larry.
Right.
Okay, so let's get into Discovery here. We're going to talk about some news that's, of course, been around for a long time. We've got a few new items that came out just today. So, yeah, you've heard a lot of this, but these are our thoughts on it. Time period set roughly 10 years before TOS. I think we talked about this, probably you and I did, as one of the last shows.
Yeah, we've had time to some of the basics, right.
Right, you know, right. Before I went in for all my eye surgery. Format 13 episodes per season is likely, although Fuller suggested 10 episodes. 13 is pretty standard for streaming shows these days. You have any new thoughts on this?
There's no like cut and dry. It's somewhere between what the BBC's done forever and what the streaming American and other streaming, you know, the premium channel and then the streaming services do. It's in that 10, 11, 12, 13 range. So no, that's...
Well, if BBC did 10 episodes, take something like Sherlock, that would be like a deluxe season of Sherlock. Right.
Right. So anyway, so yeah, it's in that front. Anyway, if someone's complaining that there's not 10, there's 13, just I'll flashing back to 1987 again and people screaming about new Star Trek in general. So I just, you know, like, let me add them. Come on, 13 is better than 10.
Well, anyone who wants 26 episodes of Star Trek in a season, I always point them to season 6 of Deep Space Nine, a wonderful season of Star Trek that ended with Time's Orphan and Prophet and Lace, two episodes that probably should have never been made because they needed 26.
If somebody complains to me about 26 episodes a season, I think I could point them to almost any season of any Star Trek.
Maybe so.
And about a fourth of them are clunkers. Because talking to the writers, they would always talk about that time about two-thirds of the way in when they would just be, they'd be behind, and there would, it right. seemed like the clinkiest of the clinkers would always be about, you know, what do you call it, the seventh inning stretch of the season, whatever. So
yeah, well, it's exhausting
to
do 26. Okay, so something that for me is fairly new since the last time I talked about Discovery is the setup we have with the ships. We have the USS Discovery,
right.
which is the title ship, obviously, but we also have the ship called the USS Shenzhou. And it seems to me, anyway, with the way they're casting and some of the news that has come out, that the Shenzhou is going to be very prominent, at least at the beginning of the series. It almost feels to me, tell me if you get this feeling, that we're looking at a show in the beginning that's going to be more about Starfleet and about two ships rather than the traditional, you know, here's our Enterprise, here's our Voyager kind of show.
Well, number one, it's 2017, not the 60s, the 80s, the 90s. And I think Brian, you know, this show, even though Brian is not executive producing actively, he's still in the credits, is not show running, that it's still the format that he set up. Now, obviously, they've probably evolved without him being there every day in the writer's room. But the casting, the writing setup, the genesis of the show was all his baby for the first several months of development. And all of the writers, well, most of the writers, are working in the world of today. And there are so many creative, non-linear, thank you, prophets, formats and storytelling. And these guys, I know, are determined to have Discovery be on the cutting edge of what can be done with formats and storytelling. And I know fans love to, I've said this so many times, they always, you know, they start the next war fighting the last one. And fans look at the next Star Trek, you know, with only being able to see the last Star Trek in their rearview mirror looking forward. So I was always confident that they would find some, and having it be 13 shows, and they, you know, each one is a standalone, but with a running arc also. So that two-level approach to the plotting, you know, I was always excited about that and also thinking, well, that's good. And people who were whining about, you know, whatever happened out of any of the last generations, well, it's different people. 10 to 15 years have gone by. We have writers who have cut their teeth the last 5 to 10 years, by and large. So none of that surprised me. And part of that is getting away from the standard crew, you know, hero ship regulars, you know, even captain, first officer, chief medical officer, chief engineer, helmsman, navigator, you know, whatever you want to call them, ops, whatever you want to call them. All of those tried and true means, we're familiar with the universe, and knowing Brian, that we weren't, things were not going to be locked into a same old, and it shouldn't be, and it should be out there, and that's the way you also attract in. Nothing about that's going to, on its surface, should. It'll be in the Star Trek universe, but the format of the storytelling will be a little bit different, but it'll be, it'll be the background of familiar Trekkies, obviously, the way they're setting this up and describing the characters.
Well, speaking of breaking out of those traditional roles, I think this is the first Star Trek series that's ever going to feature someone who specializes in space fungus.
Right. at least that we know up front. Yeah.
You remember in the original series how there were all these specialists on the Enterprise, and you never, ever saw them until the story called for them, and suddenly, the ship's chief meteorologist is going to go down.
I was just thinking that. Yes.
The planet.
Jaeger is coming with us. Or the ship's ANA officer. Oh, we have the anthropologist.
Exactly.
You know? Even Next Generation. He's the ship's literary historian. Really? Mr. Whalen, come with us. What? Okay. I'm just working on my PhD.
Spock tells Kirk, this culture is very big on rules and regulations. And then Kirk says, Lieutenant Johnson, ship's chief human resources officer, please join us in Transporter Room 3.
Can we have the ship?
We're going to need your HR skills on this.
Right. Oh, Captain, we're going to Teller Prime. Oh, better get the ship's parliamentarian down here.
Oh, right.
Parliamentarian. Yeah, I need the Roberts Rules officer. Okay.
So let me ask you about these ships. This is pure hypothetical.
Well, and you know what? We could also make a case for, there have been so many regular Klingon characters that it's probably obvious there will be some kind of a quasi. Although I've seen things about maybe a couple of episodes that really feature them, or maybe the bookend episodes, I don't know. But so many Klingon characters in this, we could maybe even add a running Klingon ship to that mix as well.
Well, it almost sounds that way, because if you look at the casting, which we'll get to in a moment, there are a couple of characters who they refer to as being officers on the Klingon ship.
Mm-hmm.
So it seems like there is going to be a specific Klingon ship that plays a big role in the story. But before we talk about that, this is purely hypothetical. If they're doing something really different here, do you think there's any chance that we start out the series with the Discovery and the Shenzhou, and then the Shenzhou gets destroyed right away in the first episode or two, and then all the crew ends up on the Discovery, and then we have a more of a traditional single ship show?
That's occurred to me. Right. And then the caretaker comes in and apologizes to all of them, and that's just the kind of, seriously, not to wear this out, this meme, but this out of the box format thinking with the 13 episode arc, standalone shows, but the overall, and having them. And the other major thing that we've known about since the beginning, almost, that Brian revealed was how this would not be, not only is it not a traditional casting of characters in a format, captain, first officer, chief medical officer, engineer, blah, 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 from a single ship, but that the lead character dramatically, for credit and billing and payroll, is going to be the first officer of the Discovery. The captain is not necessarily going to be the lead officer. So that right there tells you the point of view has shifted. And I think we're big enough to take a few different points of view in our storytelling. We know the Star Trek universe so well that I hope. Well, we've seen the internet finds something new to get excited about or upset about with Discovery every day. But I mean, that's another exciting wrinkle. And, so we're already going to look at this from a skewed point of view angle. So it's already not traditional, but it'll be exciting. It will be modern. And the underlying part there is, besides Star Trek fans, we may actually be pulling in people who find this exciting television and then come into. We may pick up new fans don't feel intimidated by not knowing anything about Star Trek. And if they have some new flashy bits like that, and if the storytelling and the approach is out of the box and that word gets out, it'll be approachable by more general mainstream fans, which is what everybody wants. And I'm sure CBS and CBS All Access wants that. So.
And Netflix, of course.
Yes, and Netflix. Yes. Excuse me, Mr. International. Yes. But we can't say Netflix too loud in the States, because that will just set off a whole row of the fandom who would get upset about that, right?
Yeah. All right. Well, that just occurred to me with the ships, because I think it's a little bit unusual to have two ships where they're completely fleshing out the crews and the casting.
It is.
But only one of them is the title of the show. Seems a little bit odd.
I'm just trying to figure out which one of the Shenzhou crew is really Khan. Oh, no, wait.
Okay. So is that how it's being pronounced? Because I haven't heard it anywhere. So Shenzhou.
Well, you're in the East Asian sphere. How would you pronounce it?
Well, for me, because of the way it's written, when we write OU, so in Japanese, all vowels are pronounced.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not like in English where you have two vowels together and they form some other sound. You actually pronounce them. So if this were Japanese, this OU would be pronounced OU. OU.
Uh-huh.
You would have to say it. And so when I see it written, that's why I think of it as like Shenzhou, which actually sounds more Chinese, but
right.
That's how I'm reading it. But I could be completely wrong on the pronunciation.
Well, you know me, when I see OU like that, I just think sooner, boomer. So, okay.
So this is Schooner Juner for
you. Yes, yes.
Yes, all right. So it's interesting how they're doing the casting. But I think it would be nice to actually have two ships involved, because one thing that I feel Star Trek has long suffered from, even with Deep Space Nine, which did try to break out of it a bit, is that small world syndrome where there's this huge galaxy and yet everyone seems to be in this one little area and there's this one ship that's doing everything.
Exactly.
All the officers know each other, even if they're on other ships. So it would be nice to see them break out of that. It would be more realistic for sure.
Exactly. Well, I'll wait for this a minute. No, that's one of the reasons why when I was a kid, after about the third or fourth go around of daily afternoon reruns, that's why I loved Journey to Babel so much, because it was the one damn time we had an inkling into what was going on beyond this. It's a cool ship, it's got cool people, but can we please see the rest of this universe? And that was, you know, a case of the little bit of the universe came to the ship. But yes.
Well, let's talk about stories and writing staff, because some of this also happened after I was last on mic. We know that the pilot was written by Brian Fuller and Alex Kurtzman. Episode 2 was written by Nicholas Meyer and Brian Fuller. Beyond that, I don't have information on specific scripts, but we have Jesse Alexander, Kirsten Beyer, Aaron, Eli Kalit, Joe Minoski, and Kemp Powers on the writing staff, and Chelsea Dowling apparently directing the entire season, which is, I mean, Star Trek seasons in the past have been long. They've been anywhere from 22 to 29 episodes. We've never had anyone direct an entire season before, right?
No. That's interesting.
People direct a number of episodes in a row, but
I think, well, they've already, that's not totally true unless we're not counting the pilot directors. There have been some leaks have gotten out. Now, one writer you didn't have here right off is Ted Sullivan, who was kind of, who had an episode, I think his episode was the third episode, and was doing these completely innocuous Instagram, Twitter images, and then may have and then they were gone within a couple of days. No spoilers at all. They were all murky background, goofy. This could be any stage at all, things. But there's a lot of people, if you're following Twitter and Instagram, there are some people who are even beyond Nicholas Meyer's dog, Star Trek dog, representing as a Twitter account. There are some fun things to get out there and follow. There are a couple of other names.
Well, here on the network, I would recommend everyone check out Stage 9 with Mike Schindler and John Mills, because they're actually quite good at following what you're talking about.
Right.
These writers who, and they've actually broken a bit of news there as well, but they keep up with what the writers are leaking out. Really good source there on Stage 9.
Right. And there's some innocuous thing. There's a running joke about, they have a little Gorn toy statuette. They talk about Jason Gorn. And apparently Jason Gorn was using my stellar cartography maps one day to plan out a battle. Anyway, it's some good fun, but yes. And the posters at the Babel conference and around, people are posting hints when somebody breaks out. Chris Obi, who plays T'Kuvma, the top leader of Klingon forces, I know they don't want to call him a captain or a commander or whatever, he had an awesome, crazy Facebook Live, Instagram Live postings, and he was in American Gods, which was Brian Fuller's other show that he sold at the same time, which was competing with this, which apparently was what won out for his time, among other things.
Right.
Neil Gaiman's huge show that's debuting just about now. He was on both, but he was live posting, being in the car with his driver, like at 4 a.m, you know, in Toronto. Apparently, it was all shooting up there, and had these outrageous, no spoilers, but just being crazy in the morning at 4 a.m. And anyway, they were entertaining. But it was a little crumb for anybody wanting to see anything having to do with Star Trek online.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. And everyone eats up those crumbs.
Yeah.
For sure. Well, let's talk about the characters and the casting, because this is really the bigger thing for me that has almost all happened after I was last podcasting. So we have Sonequa Martin-Green as the first officer of the Discovery. That's our lead, number one. And I felt like, even before they cast this character, that Fuller and others had done a good job of explaining that we're going to do something a little bit different. Mm-hmm. We're going to tell the story from a different point of view. It's not
exactly
going to be told from the captain's point of view. And I still continue to this day to see fans posting, why isn't she the captain? Like, they're not, like, they care enough about Discovery to follow the news, but they're still not getting this message that we're just going to tell the story. The fact that her rank isn't captain does not diminish the importance of the character. She is the lead of the show.
Well, part of this being in 2017, we were talking about the storytelling format not being a straight arrow, you know, as in the past. Star Trek has been around long enough, oh, some might say 50 years, 51, 2, 3 even, if you count the cage, to where, like I said, we're big enough to take a few format changes. And I think, for some reason, I've got Scotty stuck in my head tonight, but there's no McCoy lines coming to mind. But, you know, we've known the format enough so that it can acknowledge the realities, as I was saying, of modern television storytelling, especially in a time when TV, you know, beyond Star Trek, TV has busted out with the more creative forces. Since the big screen, since the feature, everything in a movie theater is either a tiny little indie cool production that you might see, but 90% of the oxygen of promotion, you know, the promotional air in the room is all going into the big superhero blockbuster movies. And that middle ground of characters and interesting formatting and storytelling and the linear plot, you know, devices and all of that is in TV now. And one of those nods would be inverting a little bit and having and not just, oh, your traditional number two is going to be the point of view character. That's very in the box and rutsy sounding. But also mm-hmm. the fact that the tone and, you know, not that we're going all dystopian, you know, and post-Holocaustal. We're not going, you know, Walking Dead here. It will be Star Trek. The hope is at the end. But DS9 may soon not be the only darker, grittier, you know, in the Zindi season of Enterprise. We may have that kind of a walk in the desert here as far as the hope and change of this Star Trek series. And the fact that this, you know, I'd said from the beginning, I bet, don't look for, when Brian was announced, the first thing I thought was, look for some things to be turned upside down in your expectations of characters and plots and all this. I mean, I was totally looking for, this has all made sense. I knew he would be a champion for, you know, having some diversity in the casting just on the surface, much less having some LGBTQ, you know, variations finally. I knew that would be on his checklist. Some diversity and inverting the storytelling and not having it be a happy-dappy, oh, everything ends with a Flintstones laugh at the end. And if this is the tale of a lieutenant commander, a second-in-command, who is also a woman of color, but there's something unnerving going on. There's something dark happening. And yes, it's Star Trek, and yes, it's 10 years before Kirk, but there's something dark happening in the corner of half of original series episodes. I mean, you know, much less Next Generation, much less DS9, much less Enterprise as the eons unravel. So all of those things with her as a locus, and then the fact that they changed the character name and you know, item number 47,000 that the internet melted down over was when they announced her new name, character name is Michael Burnham, Lieutenant Commander Michael Burnham. Well, she's a woman. How can she have a... I just tweeted a picture of Miss Michael Learned from the old Waltons, you know, original titles. And people came up with other examples too. But it's just, you know... But my point is, none of this surprised me. I think it's all welcome. I think it's fresh. I think, again, fans, calm down. As long as the entire show is not a bomb, which I doubt it will be, this is something fresh and interesting. It will be attractive to the outside world, who will be glad to see that this is not just the same old Star Trek. And the people who will be, yeah, it's just more Star Trek. Then you've got something to go, ha ha, have you watched it lately? I mean, I'm waiting next year for, whether it's Sinequa's character or something else, I'm waiting for some, or the lead aliens, we've got Klingons, but you know, something about this show, my deep dark hope is this is what the 15-year-old Comic-Con crowd cosplayers will latch onto as the hot new thing next summer, and we will all be blown away. Maybe we'll, of course, run the other gamut and we'll be resisting all these. Who are all these new kids flooding into our cons? You know, the gripey old man on the lawn. Get off my lawn, you kids. But get off my cosplay, you kids. I think this is a really good melting pot of all these kind of, you know, dynamics and all these trends and all these themes, and everything that we've seen so far totally plays into that. Although I had somebody today say, huh, there's not a Hispanic character in the whole bunch. I'm like, well, okay, guys.
Right. You know, I mean, you have a certain number of characters. You're not going to be able to cast every single.
And I'm not knocking that at all. If you did, I'm not knocking that at all.
Well,
that
and
idea,
if you did, but, right. It would feel like you're checking off boxes on a list.
Right.
Right. Instead of it feeling like an actual organic story that is meant to represent real life.
Exactly.
Larry, I know your real deepest wish about this series, though, is that, as with Enterprise, how the Andorians became such an important part of that series, you're hoping that the Tellarites play that role on Discovery, aren't you?
Well, obviously, if there's a darker, grittier tone to this series, of course we have to have Tellarites in there mixing it up. It would be, guys, don't miss this chance to be the first. You, the biggest thing about this, you know, I can see, you know, 20 years from now, we'll be saying, here's all the ticks of all the series. And then somebody will say, and of course, it was planned that Discovery would be the first streaming service show and the first one to have, you know, a two-ship format and the first one to have all this. And of course, who could have foretold that Discovery would be the first series to finally go to Teller Prime? Yes, I can totally see that. My crystal ball.
Well, Larry, you know, in this case, in the writer's room, the real question on Discovery right now is to hoof or not to hoof.
Oh, no. Well, my thing is to three finger or to five finger. So,
right. What will they do with the Tellarite hands?
I mean, the Klingon forehead's got an example, an answer. When are we ever going to have a reason for what happened to the five fingered Tellarites versus the, yeah.
Right. And you also mentioned dystopian, and I just know that no matter what happens with this show, soon the Vulcans from Impulse will not be the only Walking Dead in Star Trek.
Ah, that's true. Although, if you're talking about Sinequa, was that a not so subtle jab? Well, I was curious to see if they would let her coexist on two series, and then as they, you know, because part of the dance of you being gone, what's been funny is as they've made these, you know, fairly faithful, at least once a month announcements of new casts, and they've gone on and on and on, and sometimes multiple announcements in one day. Sinequa Martin Green's casting was reported duly, you know, because she has an agent and a manager who are thrilled to get her name out there, and nothing official from CBS. And the more that went on, I was like, oh, that wasn't in the playbook. They wanted her, you know, not announced yet for a reason. But as that went on and on and on, and month after month went by, I'm like, there's some reason. This is either clinging to her as the lead, and they just wanted to announce the lead last, which in a way didn't really make a lot of sense. We knew Scott was the first person cast in Enterprise, for starters. Then about a week or two later, I started seeing, and I'm not a big Walking Dead, you know, fan, but you can't sit down at anything that connected to the internet and not see pop culture going by and all the rumors starting up about her character lining up to be the next one killed off on Walking Dead. And I went, oh, that's what it is. Somebody had a contract somewhere that said they couldn't announce her officially until she was officially dead on The Walking Dead. So maybe that was part of the deal. There was some technicality that the world just winked at, and still, you know, those in command still had to officially go by some kind of a deal somewhere where she could, you know, she had to transfer from one to the other.
And here's some trivia for you, Larry. Do you know what my connection is to Sinequa Martin Green?
You both went to Alabama?
That's right. We both went to the University.
Well, when you set it up like that.
At the same time, though, she's a little bit younger than me.
When you set it up like that.
All right, let's talk about some of the other characters, because it is interesting to me to see who all they've put together here. We have Jason Isaacs from the OA and Outlander as Captain Lorca. He's the captain of the USS Discovery. Also made me wonder if the captain won't survive very long, and then Soniqua's character, Michael Burnham, will have to take over command of the ship. Who knows?
Right. We've seen there's been one cast before Soniqua was announced. I'm trying to think where, because they announced when they started filming back in, what, January? Mid-February, whatever it was. And if you plot out maybe 8 days, an hour, for an hour episode, and plot that forward. But there was a bunch of the cast got together for a birthday dinner, and Jason Isaacs was still into there, maybe a month into filming. I'd have to check the date. So anyway, but who knows? People could still be in touch with each other, even if they'd been killed off in filming. I have no idea about this, guys. Don't take anything I'm running. But what I'm saying is, it'll be interesting to see when people turn up at things, because I totally hear that. What will be the, you know, if these two ships continue as is and these crews remain intact, or if there's a famous melding of crews kind of concept going on here, like Voyager, what will happen? And part of the pretext of trying not to be spoilery is keeping everything separate like this and people's original designations. But anyway, it's fun. That's why it's fun to watch those off-the-cuff informal shots come out and know that after a few false starts last year, that these are all probably being totally vetted by by those that are posting, so they don't get yelled at by, so they make sure they have a whole 13 episodes.
Right. So also on the Discovery, Rekha Sharma from Battlestar Galactica and the 100, Commander Landry, security officer on the Discovery.
Yeah. Yes, Rekha, which she did a Star Trek Continues episode. She's wonderful, lovely, talented, beautiful, talented, and beautiful. Battlestar Galactica, and I loved how they said Commander Landry, security officer. And I'm thinking, I bet they meant security chief if she's a commander. She's not going to be a... I hope she doesn't... she's a security chief. I hope she's not wearing red, or if she is, she's got, you know, enough Scotty braid where she survives any Klingon tussles.
Maybe they'll just call her constable.
Right. Anyway, but it was a real thrill to... And that was just one of the announcements here today as we record this. The latest round. And anyway, it was really exciting to see her involved, because she, if you look at Trekland blog, my blog with my STV videos, my switching to visual videos, she talks about how she was a Star Trek fan, was not a Johnny Come Lately. So she's got, and a lot of the cast is probably that way. I bet Doug Jones is too, and some of the rest of them, but she's got Trek in her DNA. So hopefully that'll be a nice vibe that comes through. They're all competent professional actors, but you know there's just that little something extra, right?
And it shows in how they portray the characters. Now, this next person, I'm not great at pronouncing these names, as people know, but I think I can handle this next one, Doug Jones. I think it's pronounced Jones, right?
I don't know. He and I are wacky last names. I don't know.
So... people know him from Hellboy and Pan's Labyrinth. He's playing a character called Saru, a science officer who is a lieutenant aboard the Discovery. This one's interesting to me, Larry, because Saru in Japanese means monkey. So I think that's probably just a coincidence that I don't think that he's going to be like an alien. He's not going to be like Gleekly from the Wonder Twins or some kind of unusual alien.
Right, right, or Gene, or something. No, you know, carefully guarding any specifics. He is portraying an alien, but they have not said what it's a new alien species that has not been seen before, and obviously their Federation or the members are there enough close in, like Bajorans or Ferengi, that with a ensign row and a cadet Nog kind of affiliation, at least, you know, very careful not to mention any details. But the fact that he's getting into some kind of alien garb over there. But Doug Jones is a big favorite, has done so many genre shows. And I don't say that as any kind of a sideways knock there. I mean, he's a great actor, very adaptable, very fluid. It reminds me a little bit of Brent Spiner in that I think he's very flexible and can do, you know, all kinds of things, which exactly fits the fact that he's playing some kind of an alien. And, you know, and he's done that kind of work before. So it's 13 episodes is not 26, but, you know. Leonard in his ears and Michael Dorn in his Worf outfit, and you know, all the makeup heads on DS9 that had to do it every day so much. He'll be in for that routine to some degree, and is probably all geared up for it. So that was a good. I was pleasantly surprised, and totally makes sense to me that he's playing the alien. Good guy.
Well, whatever species he's going to be, if he has a tail, then we're going to come back to this.
Right.
If he has a long tail,
right.
We're going to come back to this Lieutenant Saru thing.
Why, Lieutenant Saru, you've developed quite an affinity for Earth bananas. That's, yes.
Exactly. Okay, we have Mary Wiseman still on the Discovery. I tried to group these, not by the order they were cast, but by ship or aliens here. Mary mm-hmm. Wiseman, Difficult People, Longmire, Baskets. She's playing a character called Tilly, who is a cadet. In her final year at Starfleet Academy, she is assigned to the Discovery. So mm-hmm. it's good to have a cadet on there. Hopefully it's not Peter Preston.
Right. Or... Captain Waters or any of the other,
Or the entire crew of the Valiant.
That's what I was trying to get to, right. Nova so, Squadron, Red Squadron, report, whatever, whoever's taking
we've
over.
We've got the full range here.
Right.
Terry Serpico from Army Wives and Rescue Me as Starfleet Admiral Anderson. Now, this is very important for me, Larry. This is pre-TNG era, so we're talking 23rd century here. I'm just wondering if the Starfleet School of Fashion is going to have their full belt buckle curriculum going yet for admirals. Like, what kind of belt buckle is Anderson going to wear? And what are the shoulder pads going to be like?
Well, now we saw some original series pajama top admirals, but... I think, or did they? We only see them
like
sitting
the
down.
Big, huge belt buckle.
Right. Yeah. Oh, right.
Because, well, you know, one of the great things about being an admiral is not only do you get to choose your own ship, you also get to design your own uniform.
Your own, yes, your own buckle, because it changed. Uniform and dress uniform. You know, oh, which is which? Right. Who can tell after a while? Yeah.
All right. So Michelle Yeoh from Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon mm-hmm. is playing a character called Georgiou, which I'm probably also mispronouncing, captain of the USS Shenzhou, which we've been talking about. So I'm expecting her character to be quite prominent. This is my feeling, and I may be wrong, but mm-hmm. the way the casting news came out, I kind of feel like Soniqua's character and Michelle's character are going to be the two most prominent characters. I don't know why I have that feeling.
No clue.
But I do. No clue. You're crazy, Chris. I have no idea. What's going on in your
have
head?
Two women be the lead characters? Are you crazy, man?
But clearly when they did your eye surgery, they snipped something that connects to your brain also.
Right. Just a little, leaking a little brain juice there. No. Who knows? Who knows? But she was the first person. In fact, there was a leak. Remember this? Nick Meyer?
That's why I feel that way.
Nick Meyer yeah. accidentally mentioned her in like an innocuous yeah. interview about a few days ahead of... A couple of days after everybody blurted this out, then came the regular CBS release of the first two or three cast members, and she was in that. It's kind of funny.
Yeah. That might be why I feel that way, because she was that mm-hmm. first name and someone known. So, all right. Malik Pancholi from 30 Rock and Weeds, I remember mm-hmm. him in both of those, is playing the chief medical officer of the Shenzhou, Dr. Nambu,
right?
Nambue, whichever one it's going to be.
Interesting that I don't think there's an engineering officer in any of these characters, and the only medical officer, you know, chief doctor, is Dr. Nambu here, Malik's character, and it's designated as from the Shenzhou. So again, the only doctor in the cast is from that. So that's why if they're not formally merged, the fact these two ships may be. Or individual people from crews may be loaned out back and forth. Who knows? But, you know, just looking at cast role, character roles, they'll need a doctor sometimes when they're not on the, you know, what all the medical situations are going to happen on the Shenzhou.
Yeah.
You know, what's that?
I've got it, Larry. So this series may not be connected to the Kelvin timeline, the J.J. Abrams movies, but I just have this vision of from time to time, the ships, they come, they fly fairly close to each other. And when they need a doctor, for example, that they don't have on the other ship, they just put on the big helmet, the mask, and they space jump from one ship to the other.
They live action anime across from one ship to the other. Yeah. There must be a name for that.
That way you get a little more action into the episode.
That way you get a little more Asian market audience into the... That's for the global market. Yes.
All right. So then we have Anthony Rapp from Dazed and Confused, mm-hmm. and also from Rent, who I mentioned earlier on, who's really into space fungus. This is Lieutenant Stamets, a science officer specializing in astromycology, which is the study of fungi in space.
Fungi in space!
Yes, exactly. And I'm picturing the ship looks like a giant fungus. Just, it's got little engines on the back. You've got the fire coming out.
Just like the, what is the Muppet shows? The USS Swine Trek? Yes.
The Swine Trek, yeah. Which was also seen in the Enterprise episode Precious Cargo, because the ship that Trip and the princes escape onto the planet from apparently is the ship from Pigs in Space. Looks just like it.
That explains a lot for that poor episode.
Yes.
Yes, but we should also say seriously that Lieutenant Stamets is a gay character. Not to, put a big brass plaque on it, but that's a first, another first for this series, and one of, I'm sure, on the laundry list of things that Brian wanted to do, maybe even overdue, that he wanted to bring to this series. So,
and first for a lead, or our main character.
Yes, for a main character.
Ongoing, episode after
and
episode.
And what I'm waiting to do is to have that be in the bio and do all 13 episodes and have it never be a plot issue. I would so love for
right,
that to
which
happen.
Is, yes. Which is how it should be done, and hopefully it will be done, because if you're portraying it as like, this is normal life, this is how the real world is,
right,
then that's...
Right.
How it would be, right?
Especially in, if we could say that about Picard being, remember the big answer to, my God, you've got a bald captain. What do you say about that? And Jean said, by the 24th century, no one will care. And, of course, you could apply that to almost anything that we get our panties in a wad about now. So,
don't you think by the 24th century, if you're bald, you're doing it to make a statement, because you don't have to be bald with 24th
century
science?
Well, that's what people said about Scotty and Chekhov's, in the early days about their accents. Wouldn't Earth by then be so blended that things like and globalized and, and even off planet that accents would be a thing of the past? And it's like, oh no, it's a cultural heritage that they're like a beard. They're specially manicuring that.
Okay. Well, that raises a question that I have now, Larry, which you are uniquely qualified to answer.
Uh-oh.
How do they explain McCoy's beard and leisure suit and giant necklace in the motion picture when he first comes aboard the Enterprise? Is that a statement that he was making right there?
It was.
That's the answer.
The statement is,
and what was that statement,
Larry? The statement is that in the future, even rural Georgia can be just as disco as you damn well want to be. That's what it is.
There you go. That's the answer I wanted. Now it all makes so much more sense to me.
damn it, Jim, I'm just an old disco country doctor. That's all it was.
I was boogieing down and you dragged me out of retirement. Use some damn claws to get me back into service? Yeah.
Yes.
All right. So, I need your moves, Bones. Okay.
Bones, I need your bling. I need your bling, Bones.
I need your bling. All right. So, who else do we have here in the cast?
You blang?
Okay, Sam Vartholomeus, however you pronounce his name. Vartholomeus, it sounds Greek.
Yes.
The Secret Life of Walter Mitty, The Following, these are things we've seen him in. He is playing a junior officer named Connor, who is in Starfleet Academy, and he's going to be on the Shinjo. So we are working in the cadets here.
Mm-hmm.
Any thoughts on Sam?
No, obviously not all of these are going to be... When we get down to ensigns and cadets and all of that, obviously some are leads and some are lessers. The fact that this is a 13-episode series that's an arc it's almost like we're casting, what is that, like six movies at once. So there's room for a lot of characters, but there'll still be some leads and there'll be some secondary characters. And I, you know, the natural thing is to look at the ensigns and the lower, you know, to take the Starfleet actual ranks as their real life, you know, share of the plot of screen time, not to denigrate the character or the actor at all, but there's got to be leads and there's got to be secondary characters and there's got to be some, maybe even a third tier. And I mean, that struck me a few months ago. They're so anxious as the delays have set in. CBS is probably looking for ways to keep some interest, much as some people think they're determined to, you know, stuff all the good spoilers in a vault somewhere. CBS really is anxious to keep excitement going. And the fact that we're having an assortment of characters who are probably obviously going to be at different levels of participation screen-wise. I mean, that's just my guess. But, you know, Sam Bartolomeos, yeah. I'll take a stab at it, is probably one of those.
That sounds pretty good. I like that.
Yeah, and hope, you know, who knows? I really hope we're not getting some poor person's picture, like you said, who's going to get killed off in the pilot. But it is 13 episodes. It is modern television. You know, one thing we haven't talked about is, if not just a pilot setup like Cavett, you know, in the Voyager setup, or the unnamed, you know, chief medical officer, the people on Voyager that died in the pilot, we may, you know, it's, again, it's 2017. We may have characters that totally survive the pilot, but something happens by episode 4 or episode 7 or episode 9. We'll have to see. But that's something to keep in mind, you know, just because they survive the setup may not mean that they're with us all for all 13.
Well, it's a good point talking about how they keep announcing different casting news to keep interest up. Now, eventually they're going to run out of cast members to talk about. And if the release keeps getting delayed, let's say it gets pushed into early 2018, we're going to start getting StarTrek.com announcements about, you know, so-and-so was just named to the craft service.
Right.
You know, new janitorial staff member will be cleaning up the Klingon sets after each day's shooting.
Talk about a deep dive.
They'll have a great photo of each of these people that they can put in the hero there on the front page of the website.
Right. Well, let's hope so not.
Let's run through the rest of these, because we do want to talk about a few more things besides Discovery here on this episode. So we have James Frayne from Orphan Black and True Blood and Gotham playing Sarek.
And the second Tron.
And the second Tron. He's the second Sarek. No, he's actually the very first Sarek. No, so how do you feel about Sarek being in the series? And do you think he will play a bigger part than just a cameo in one episode?
Well, it was really interesting because at the very beginning, when Brian was being very intriguing but non-spoilerific, like about the time of the Comic-Con last summer announcements and the really raw, barely there sneak preview trailers, he made some off-the-cuff comment about trying to be vague and intriguing about how he loved the character of Amanda. He loved the character of Amanda.
Yeah, I remember
and
that.
Then months later, here comes the announcement of James Frayne playing a Sarek, which at the time I thought, was that just misdirection, or did they intend to have Amanda first and they decided to have Sarek? Or was he doing that just to be coy and cute? Or, you know, or what was that all about? Maybe we'll yet have an Amanda, because obviously she exists. They're married. Spock's, you know, Spock's 10 years younger than we know. Spock is, this is April era, or Pike era, I should say. So, I don't know. No, I'm fine. And not to jump ship, but we've, you know, Sarek came first, which was intriguing. So we know at least there'll be a Vulcan in this. Although the fact that we may see whether he's going to be a 13-episode appearance or whether he's just in two or three, we don't know. Mm-hmm. But the same thing could be said of much later over your time away, but when Rainn Wilson was announced as Harry Mudd. And the internet kind of, I think, melted down in joy. I thought that was kind of funny. I think the overall reaction there was positive. But there's two characters, not to jump ahead on you, but there's two characters that we know. So it's almost like we've got some, we do have some touchstones. And, you know, there was a time when Brian was still attached to this and working earnestly and talking about he could see maybe having some, if not Kirk, Spock, McCoys, maybe some other characters that we know from the time frame popping in maybe the second season, or maybe a really, really cute, coy, maybe we have, you know, 10-year-old Pavel Chekhov or something popping in. But he said, whatever, if it would get to, he wouldn't want to get too cute because he wouldn't want all the focus the first season to be on developing the new characters and not do that. But again, here's two very definite fan favorites, very important to, especially Sarek, very important to the Star Trek universe, especially in Prime. I guess in both of them. But and then Harry Mudd, of all things, who's never, you know, after Roger C. Carmel died during the first season of Next Generation, all talk about having Harry Mudd pop up somehow. You know, as a in a cryo tube or something, holodeck or whatever, went away, and no one's ever uttered the name Harry Mudd, as far as I know, until now. So that was actually kind of and Rainn Wilson as a casting choice. That was that would be interesting.
It's interesting, yeah, but I can see it. I think it could be good. I'm glad they didn't cast Jack Black, which is who they were always talking about casting as Harry Mudd. When the rumors that Harry Mudd might appear in one of the earlier J.J. Abrams films, and it's just an actor I don't like. So I'm glad they didn't go that route. Rainn Wilson could be quite interesting. All right, let's run through the last little group here. These are the Klingons. Mm-hmm. So Chris Obi, you already mentioned, who apparently is going to be Star Trek's first Vulcan Klingon because the character's name is T'Kuvma, which sounds like some kind of Vulcan woman's name.
I know. Now, come on. T'Kuvma. Chris. Don't fall into your anal fanboy box rut here now. Let's you know, young minds, new times. Tisk, tisk.
Well, I'm just waiting for the episodes that explain how many Klingon names started with T apostrophe something, and then Sarek, during the time of Discovery, was so taken with that he went back to Vulcan and he introduced that tradition to Vulcan, and it became common with Vulcan women's names. It's probably going to be a three-part episode that bridges this for us in canon.
Just don't tell T'Pol that 100 years earlier when Archer was visiting Vulcan, but yes.
Well, that's the big reveal, Larry, is that actually the Klingons stole it from the Vulcans.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. So Shakespeare from the humans and female names from the Vulcans. Got it, Chris.
That's right.
That'll be a shocker. No, that's, you know, it's diversity. People get all upset about little things like that, and I say, you know what, eventually, I mean, there's so much that we've assimilated over the years that when it first popped up, as we went from the original series into the movie, into the first movie, then into the middle movies, then into Next Gen, and then the first thing that kind of goes against the flow, people get all upset about, but then it becomes the diamond in the rough. It becomes texture, right? It becomes the thing that goes against the grain that brings things to life. It's the exception that proves the rule. And I'm sure we'll be able to accept a Klingon whose name starts with T apostrophe soon.
I hope so.
Anyway, Chris Obi, he has a very entertaining live feed, if you catch on to him.
So we have Shahzad Latif as Cole, except now we don't, because they have recast Shahzad Latif as Lieutenant Tyler, a Starfleet officer, and now they've cast Kenneth Mitchell from the Astronaut Wives Club as Cole, which means that any scenes with Cole that have already been shot are going to have to be reshot now with Kenneth Mitchell.
Interesting. And he's...
This is kind of an odd thing, right? Like in the middle of production to recast someone.
Well, let's see. I don't know. What was that pilot for that one Star Trek where they got 2 days shot and they had to recast? The lead?
But not pilot. But at this point, if we're 4 months into shooting...
That's true. Or how much...
probably shot a number of things.
Yes, but maybe he wasn't in every single episode. Maybe it wasn't that dire a situation. It'll be interesting to find out the reason for that. Did his skin not take Klingon makeup, you know, very well?
Oh, maybe he was allergic to the makeup.
Right. Could be. Or whatever. Maybe he had a scheduling problem. It just could not be overcome. I don't know. I don't know what's bigger than Star Trek, but there are rumors that there are things. So anyway,
maybe he did not like... the T apostrophe thing, he refused to be T'Kol, and they had to just say, okay, well, look, we're gonna make you Tyler, we're gonna take the apostrophe out. It was T'Iler, but it's not T'Iler anymore, it's just Tyler, so you, calm down.
I'd forgotten about you and your tangents, Chris. The 9 months away has been good to you here, but I was just gonna say Ken Mitchell, we were talking about the Astronaut Wives Club, but a lot of fans, you know, Jericho, he was in Jericho. He was Eric Green in Jericho, and that was a very a big fan favorite with the nuts protest, and it was on the bubble and had its own little fan saving it for another season and all that. But I love the Astronaut Wives Club, and he was Deke Slayton. And somehow I thought that him getting, especially getting into a role that was being recast for him, somehow it's like the karma of Deke Slayton never getting to have his original Mercury flight. Now here he is, he's number two. He's like the sidekick to Kuvma, protege, excuse me, as they said in the casting, to Kuvma. That just seems right and fair that Deke is going to get some more star hours, some more space miles in under his belt. And guys, for anybody who's not a big Right Stuff, actual NASA history, you know, Mercury 7 fan, Deke Slayton was the one of the Mercury 7 who had the medical problem and never got to fly until they made him head of the astronaut corps. And then years later, he got to fly a shuttle, or he flew one of the later flights years later. But that's what my little Deke sidebar was about. Anyway, I love the Astronaut Wives Club. If you love the space program history, go watch the Astronaut Wives Club. And now we continue.
And now we'll find out that the real reason he didn't get to fly is that he was a Klingon.
Right.
And that just didn't go over well with the human space agency.
Right.
All right. Well, moving on with Klingons, Mary Sheffo is Larel. That's L'Rell, a battle deck commander. Claire McDonnell as Dennis, no apostrophe. I don't know what's going on there. It should be Dennis, a leader in the Klingon Empire. And Damon Runyon as Ujili, a leader in the Klingon Empire.
See, you're all up about the apostrophes, Ujili. That's just, I think Brian's original urge to show more diversity in the show also extends to the Klingons. We're going to have more Klingon diversity in this show than ever. I think these names are going to represent different tribes and sects and, you know, sects, areas of the homeworld or whatever.
You're probably right, because some of the things I've been reading is that part of this Klingon storyline seems to revolve around an effort to bring together a unified Klingon empire. So some of these different leaders may be from different sects.
Oh, I was totally kidding, but okay, I'll let it go. Right.
So that could be the case. You know, maybe you bring together the apostrophes and the non-apostrophes.
Right.
You get them at the table. They talk. They have some gach. They have some blood wine. And next thing you know, they're ready to go kick the Federation's ass.
Next thing you know, they're even letting in the vowel starters.
Yeah. All right. So that's our casting. That was a very, very long segment. I didn't anticipate it being that long, but it's interesting because most of these people weren't cast when I put down the mic for the surgery. Mm-hmm. Okay, quickly, let's run through production and delays. The show, it's hard to believe, because I remember when they made the announcement, you and I hopped on the mic right away and we did a Ready Room about it. That was November 2015. And they announced at that time that they would launch the series in January of 2017, which has already come and gone. The first teaser was shown at Upfronts May 2016, then October 2016, a few months after I stopped podcasting. Fuller stepped down, Berg and Harberts took over, and then production finally began January 2017, which was the original release month. Then they said, okay, the show's going to come out May 2017. Well, that's not going to happen. Now it's mid to late 2017, or maybe later. Les Moonves said in February during a conference call with investors that Discovery would debut in the late summer or early fall, but the timeline may be more flexible. Who knows when it's going to appear? And I don't really know what to think other than eventually I think they're going to put it on television.
Well, and this is getting people... I mean, I'm not... Okay, here's the interesting thing about this. I don't know anyone. Fans are upset. There's a daily meltdown every day. There's a general malaise. Now, maybe there's other things going on in the world that are adding to this. Maybe people had their hopes up for Discovery. Maybe people were setting their clocks by its debut. I don't know. I'm disappointed that it's dragging out. But you know what? I am sure that everybody from Les Moonves on down is disappointed that it's dragging out. I'm sure everybody connected with the show is disappointed, but they are filming. they're probably by now at least 4 or 5 or 6 episodes in. They're still announcing cast. Some of these casting we get may be characters that are only now being cast because they don't show up until the 4th or 5th or 6th or 7th episodes or whatever, you know? And they may be able to keep sprinkling those out there as they film along on the 13. But my point is, I don't think anyone's happy about it, but they are committing the money to it. What's been heartening to me, and I said this when we had the first delay, the very first delay, is that they are being intelligent. I mean, you know, you've probably been involved in the project. We've all been in a project where the planning did not exactly go as it was supposed to. Con of Wrath. I was only a visitor. I was not part of it. But the bottom line is there comes a point, we see this in government, we see this in any, you know, private business, we see this in sports, we see this in artistic and, you know, theatrical. We get to a point where we realize there's a problem or a series of problems, and if we're good at it, we're able to make a fix, and the temptation is to stop right then and diagnose everything, right? But if you've got a deadline for your project, or you've got a program that needs a deadline, or you've got a release date, or you've got to open your show, whatever it is, you've got a concert coming, the main thing, the overriding thing becomes, be ready for what you've got to do. We'll go back and diagnose what happened later. Coupled to that, the fact that somebody was, we were talking about this the other day, every Star Trek, after a long gap, when you've got the benefit of the well-oiled machine, sure, DS9 and Voyager have their hiccups, you know, recasting your lead female captain. But that's nothing compared to, you know, it took them 2 pilots and convincing a world that had no clue what Gene was trying to do to sell the original series. That was a miracle. Bringing it back was a miracle, although they basically launched Next Generation when they intended to. But there are all kinds of bumps and things along the way. And then, the JJ movies were, you know, what, 6 months later. And that was an interesting ride back. And starting up, not just the casting and the writing, but you've got the factory, the machinery of a show, and Star Trek, especially all the spinoffs. I don't know what's harder, the original series or all the spinoffs after that in the expectation game. It's not like any other show out there. It's not like, because you've got now, you had the expectations aside from doing it right and doing a good production. So sometimes if you're new to that, you may not get it. And now you've added in the fact that this is CBS All Access streaming, and you've got a layer of people. None of these people have worked with Star Trek before that are in leadership roles in producing. So, I mean, you know, Nick Meyer and Brian. But I mean, to communicate that around the horn about what's involved and how much R&D there might be, you can only, you know... Anyway, some of these delays, and if the conceptual evolution of the show then reverberated, you can't build sets until you've actually, you can't design costumes, you can't design makeup, you can't cast until you've finished all your evolutionary touches and tweaks and all that to your conceptual ideas. And you may have artists sketching, but sketches go through, you know, artists sketching and CGI artists doing modeling. And all that may take, and it just can be a ramp up. And to their credit, I would rather see the delays happen, if they're going to happen, than have it be rushed. Right. And we've said this before. So to their credit, and you know, the other thing is, we're looking at it as fans, or most people here on the Trek side are looking at this as fans, thinking, is it going to be a good Star Trek or not? The stockholders of CBS and people who have a job to keep, hopefully, and won't get, you know, axed over this. If this somehow blows up, then it becomes an industry CBS thing. And nobody, you know, they don't want that for sure. So, again, on several different levels here, it's in everybody's best interest. Everybody, no one is thrilled that it's had delays, but it's in everybody's best interest to make sure it's a good product. And I would give, you know, Moonves on down credit for, through all the iterations, before Brian's departure, afterwards, and all of that, I'm giving them credit for working out the bugs, you know, because the next 13 will be much easier, unless it's a radical departure in format or something. But the next 13, they'll be battle-hardened veterans in the production corps, and they will be much easier to deal with than these first ones. But, you know, Star Trek's always had a big startup, and whenever you've had a long gap, It just takes time. It's a complex thing. I'm just thrilled that they recognize that and are giving it space to breathe, no matter how frustrating it is for us, no matter how frustrating it is for all the stockholders who are hoping there'd be, you know, Star Trek revenue behind All Access by now.
Well, it's interesting for me because I have so many things going on in my life that I'm looking forward to seeing Discovery, but I'm not sitting around thinking, well, is it going to premiere this month? Is it going to premiere next month?
Are we there yet? Are we there yet?
Just thinking. Are we there yet? Like you said, I'm glad that they're working out. If there are issues, I'm glad that they're working them out so that the final product that they put out is as good as it can be. And if I have to wait another month or 2 months or even 6 months to see that, that's fine because I have plenty of other things that I need to worry about and do every day. And I would certainly rather them get it right than rush it. So for me, I don't understand other than you need a story these days, right? You always need a story in media. And of course, the fans latch on to that, but it's largely driven by the news sites that need to have a headline.
The 24/7 drip, 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 which get ridiculous.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. So I'm sure that it will come out and I'm pretty sure it'll be good because the people they have on both sides of the camera, it's hard for me to imagine that they're going to put out a subpar product and it's Star Trek. So I think it will be fine.
I mean, I have no illusions that we won't have all kinds of, you know, especially at the beginning as we get used to this. We may have huge issues and, oh my God, she's supposed to be a Vulcan and she cried. I mean, there may be all kinds of things when they're fresh that 10 years from now we'll kind of go, that got smoothed out into the flow of, you know, greater Star Trek. I'm sure we'll have all those little debates, macro and micro, and all of that will happen. That's the fun of fandom. It's the fun of Star Trek. But these people, the internet people who are saying, this will never see the light of day, it's still going to fail. Like, if it is, it will take down so many people at the network that they've spent this much time and energy and millions on this so far. It's like, no. This will be out. We can debate the fine points of it, you know, the good, bad of it, but don't say this will never, you know, I still think it's going to fail and never see the light of day. No.
Larry, a Vulcan crying, that's nothing. Those photos of Klingons that we saw a while back and people were all up in arms about the makeup.
Oh, the leak?
That's nothing. Yes. What's really going to set off the internet and fandom is when we see for the first time that the Tribbles in Discovery are hairless.
Right. I'm out of here then. I'm out. No way.
Let me ask you one more thing.
A visible mouth.
Right. So that's what they look like when they talk.
Right.
I didn't know. So you mentioned 2009, the J.J. Abrams film, and when that was being put together. One potential similarity here is that that script was being written when the last big writer's strike happened. And we have the potential here of Discovery getting caught up in a writer's strike.
That's another, yes.
So how real do you think this is? You're there in Hollywood. And how would it impact the show if it happens?
I haven't. Well, first of all, it was kind of funny because I haven't been paying close attention. And the WGA, Writers Guild, East and West, did take a strike vote, but they did that to as a barometer to show solidarity when they went back to the table for the next round of the contract's supposed to be up here in just a few days. By the time this is out, we may have some more updates on this. Again, every time there's the contract was a 10-year, you know, what's amazing to me, Chris, is I can't believe it's been 10 years since we had the strike in 2007-08. Mm-hmm. And by then we had theme pickets, and one of the days was in mid-December. We had the Star Trek picket where, you know, and the Screen Actors Guild and the Directors Guild were all sympathy striking also. So everything truly was shut down, which is another question that is hanging over this. If there really is a Writers Guild, will the other guilds strike also? Because technically, if something was written, it would be filmable. You couldn't make tweaks to it and change it.
Well, you couldn't make tweaks to it. That's sometimes the issue.
Right.
When they go back and fix something and then they can't.
But if the other guilds strike, you know, the last time a lot of the contracts were coming up and the other guilds were supporting the Writers Guild because the writers' contract was the first one to expire and they wanted to be in solidarity with them because their times were coming up within a few weeks and months. And if we're on that kind of cycle still, I haven't checked into that. it's just amazing to me that it has been 10 years and that we had the strike and that there was, it was like a little Trek reunion and all these writers from all the different eras. It was the last big story that the old StarTrek.com, when it was a full news team, Mark Waid and Tim Gaskell and Sandy Stone and myself, we covered that and did a ton of pictures. In fact, I've been thinking about doing a round, 10 years ago roundup. But whenever those strikes happen, and then, of course, the famous 88 strike that affected Next Generation's second season,
right. End
of first season, into the second season, it always happens when there's a collision between the existing contract and new technology, which is happening more and more and more and more. And, you know, even in the 81 strike that happened barely, and then the 88 were all about the rise of whenever there's a new technology movie stream, whether it was, you know, in the beginning it was just VHS tapes and rental tapes and premium channel, like HBO and Showtime, and then increasingly, DVDs, and now, my God, we've got all the streaming services. And the other thing that's happened, speaking of evolving formats, is these 13 episode seasons are cutting into where a writer would say, I'm on for the whole season. Well, a whole season did used to be 22 or 26 shows. Now it's 10 or 12. And a lot of their incomes are down, and the way things are jiggered and scaled, writers are getting, they're losing. They're losing out. So these strikes, the contracts, when they come up, instead of it's just an automatic, renewal, well, no, there's a whole new world happens in 10 years, as we all know, and that's why they're out to do that, so they don't lose out for another 10 years of that. That happened some in the 60s and 70s, and they were, some of the old-timers said, never again let this happen. So I don't know. The strike vote happened as a signal to go back to the bargaining table. We'll see what happens. If they do strike, we'll see if the other guilds go out on them. I do know that they're shooting in Toronto. The writers are here in LA. People have said, will it shut down production? I don't know how many scripts ahead they are. If they've got all 13 written, which I doubt, and at least, usually scripts get tweaked on right before they're shot. At least, so I would think.
Or while they're being shot?
While they're being shot, definitely. But I mean, like at the very earliest, they might lock before. But yeah, our situations happen in shooting where you have to change something or whatever. Yeah, it could affect the filming. The other thing is that they're shooting in Canada, but they're all done with, guild, what would be the word? The American contracts and the American guilds are acknowledged. And may even overlap into Canada and people who work back and forth across the board. Even though the Canadians, have a lot of cultural things trying to preserve the cultural, all the guilds and all the artistic and entertainment areas as other fields of life, so that they're not just totally invaded by Americans, and so that there's prominent skin of the Canadians in their own country. But there's still the contractual basis to go back and forth. And what I'm trying to say is there's no insulation for the fact they're filming in Canada against all this, just because they're American-based guilds. So it'll depend on if the other big guilds go in solidarity. But the very bottom line is some of this vagueness about a debut may have to be the executives are hedging their bets about whether there is a strike or not, which could throw all of us into another few months of delay.
Could be. All right. Well, that's Star Trek Discovery. Everyone, again, we covered a lot of news you've heard before, but a lot of it's new for me in terms of being able to podcast about it. So
just humor Chris, guys. Just humor Chris.
That's right. Okay. So Larry, the other thing I want to talk about, now that we're an hour and 18 minutes into our discussion between the two of us.
We'll fly.
Just looking back at last year, 50th anniversary, some of the things that happened, because I basically missed the last half of the year.
Chris, I am so glad that 2016 was the 50th anniversary of Star Trek, because there are other events that happened in 2016 that leave me a little bedraggled. But thank God we had the 50th anniversary of Star Trek to celebrate last year. And it was an amazing year.
Yeah. Now, I did not get to come over to the States for conventions or anything like that. But of course, you were there at Star Trek Las Vegas. And you went to other cons, and you even went to London, right? So just quick summary. I mean, how was the 50th for you personally going to these events?
It was amazing, and I didn't get to the 50th, the Reed Pop convention that was new in New York, but no, it was amazing. The Vegas went to 5 days. It was chock full. There were some amazing moments. Creations convention there. Whoopi Goldberg's first convention appearance. They love to say that it was Kirstie Alley's first convention appearance, although that's not true, because anyone who's following The Con of Wrath knows that she was at the Ultimate Fantasy in Houston 82. But obviously, after she was she did a couple more conventions. She did one.
Maybe that's why she didn't do any more, Larry, after that one. Right?
Yeah, I think the recasting had a lot to do with why she didn't do any more for a long time. She had a career to get on with. But those were awesome moments. I've said this before. I've seen some criticism of the way Paramount and CBS, the divorced parents working together, handled the 50th anniversary. I don't know what more. We started the year not knowing there would be we entered into the celebration season not knowing that there'd be a series, yeah, and knowing that there would be Beyond. I think Beyond was the best, not because it was a 50th anniversary as a ingredient of its success, but I think Beyond was the best movie so far. That was a bonus. The huge thing was, there'd never been, since Comic-Cons and San Diego as the granddaddy, the big Comic-Con boom the last 10, 15 years has happened since the Trek peak, yeah, right? Since the TV, yeah, boom. There'd never been a big footprint for Star Trek at San Diego. And this year there was a huge thing. There was a Spock graphic on the front of the events guide. And with the debut there outdoors, it was a huge splash. I know our friends at CBS Licensing at Consumer Products were thrilled. MAC Cosmetics, there were some big name tie-ins. There was a bigger Star Trek presence than ever with the movie. Some of the box office really puzzled me, but as it turned, yeah, out. But I know the buildup and the attention and the buzz that was in mainstream as well as in fandom had never been seen before. And that was a huge part of it too. But the cons have been awesome.
Let me ask you about Beyond real quick. I've seen it a couple times. I finally did get to see it in the theater, and then I have it on Blu-ray because Norman Lau, who everyone here on the network knows, who appears on the Ready Room from time to time, was hosting Standard Orbit and was an executive producer with us, sent me a Blu-ray as a gift as I, mm-hmm, suffered through my eye surgeries, which was so nice of Norm.
And the delayed Japan premiere, right? Didn't you get it late?
Well, I got the Blu-ray from Norm before it opened in the theater.
That's what Japan. I'm saying, right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. Well, what I want to ask you is, talking about, you said it's the best of those movies. The first 20 minutes of that movie, I think, are wonderful. That it really, for the first time in any of the J.J. Abrams Star Trek, they captured the feeling of the original series and the relationship between Kirk and Spock and Bones and what life's like on the Enterprise and the kind of classic TOS feel of going down to a planet, that opening scene with Kirk. Mm-hmm. It felt so Star Trek to me. And then it shifted a bit after they got into the meat of the movie. But what did you think about that first 15, 20 minutes?
Well, you know, there'd been a big, again, people were, you know, just wringing their hands about Beyond with the late start that it got when they changed, when Bob Orsi's team was removed from writing and directing, and they went to Justin Lin and Simon Pegg's script, and it was all done. I had visions of the motion picture. You know, it's digital, but I'd see them shipping wet digital prints on the day before it was supposed to premiere. That kind of a rush job made me worry, but then, you know, and mm-hmm, through the promotion behind, and the May 20th event they had at Paramount, that they did a kind of a Hail Mary catch-up, you know, big springboard into trying to get back into the public consciousness with promotion, I thought went really well. And we saw people there live, saw a total of 15 minutes of the film, and part of the you know, quiet scene and then the action scene. And both, yeah, components, the quiet scene was the Kirk McCoy scene in their little bar with the drinking, it was such a Pike Boyce moment feeling.
Yeah, it was
from
Pike Boyce,
yeah,
and it was great.
And then the action scene was when the when all the little dare I say the swarm ships, haha, Voyager fans,
yeah,
when the,
yeah,
swarm ships attacked them, and it was so visceral and vicious, and it was actiony. But it was done so well. It was action with a purpose and action with a brain, not just gratuitous, goofy action to be action. And it just looked like, you know, someone had the horses by the reins and all the horsepower was driving down the road in one direction. And I apologize for all the wacky mixed metaphors here. But, you know, again, the action felt like there was a purpose to it. So anyway, everybody left that night feeling really pumped up. And it had the desired effect of getting fan buzz and the professional buzz and the media buzz going, since, yeah, since they'd missed out on some earlier opportunities. So,
and I don't think the entire movie rose up to that, as a whole, but there are those parts, and especially that opening where I think it did, and they did a really nice job.
Oh, we could, yeah.
Yeah. But this is not a Beyond discussion, but since you mentioned it, I wanted to mention, because I don't think I've had a chance to podcast about Beyond.
We're being very patient tonight, Chris. We're being very patient to indulge you. Yes. I say we.
And then back in 2012, when I couldn't podcast. No, I'm just kidding. So let's talk about, after Star Trek, well, not after, leading up to Star Trek Las Vegas, Geek Nation Tours, you and Terrace do this, and not to give a whole recap of the tour, but every year you and Terrace, you try a few new things and you learn a few new things. What did you learn this time that you're going to carry forward?
Well, like everybody, you know, I said a year ago when people in 2015, I started calling it 5-0 fever. People just went bonkers for the 50th. People who hadn't been to Vegas, people who hadn't done anything in their fandom around the world, people who had been retired from fandom. I started calling them gap fans. I saw people who hadn't been active since the 60s and 70s who were jumping in for the 50th. So much, so many levels of fandom, so many regions of fandom were getting inspired and activated, and people were getting in ahead for the cruise that actually happened, you know, just past January. People were so excited, and people were worried about Vegas selling out and the hotels and the tickets. And I went, oh, that's never going to happen. And it did. And there was just so much of that. And Geek Nation Tours, we added a San Francisco component for the first time. It was the third time. You know, every 2 years we'd offered this. And that was about what the demand so far has been for it to make. We had the biggest crowd. It sold the fastest. We had an awesome time. We had people come back with us for a second go because we swapped out some stops in LA. We added everything in San Francisco. It made it longer with the option to do both or just one. And it was just an incredible time. It was just great, you know, seeing new people still, old faces that way. You know, Vegas is that way, but everything about fandom is that way. But, you know, we had an awesome time. Some of the best of our, you know, goodies, like having Bobby Clark come over and talk about filming Arena at Vasquez Rocks, you know, putting all those ingredients together. But yeah, the walking up and down the Double Dumbass on You corner in San Francisco, and going out to the
did people reenact that scene? Did they go out in the street and yell Double Dumbass on You to cars? As
it was, and we only had to take two people to the hospital. It was amazing. We did way better on that than I was expecting. Right.
That was the hospital in Alameda.
Right. Well, we didn't do the hospital in Alameda, but we went out to the the Sausalito Aquarium, which is actually in Monterey.
Yeah.
But no, we did some new things in LA too. So it was wonderful. And I just real quickly, so this year is our off year for the big tour, but we are doing, for anybody that's going to Vegas this year, we have the 1 day Valley of Fire tour where they filmed the scenes in Generations, plus some other wacky things that have kind of come along, some surprising things that are at the Valley of Fire State Park, an hour on the other side of Vegas from the LA side. And we do that as a 1 day tour. I call it the Kirk Memorial Tour. But every time we've gone, we've learned something new, which is kind of interesting. So I just direct, you know, people come to my site or go to geeknationtours.com and look for the Valley of Fire if you're interested. If you're, there's enough con creep. People keep adding to their STLV experience a day on each end. It seems like people are there in the middle of June now saying, hey, everybody, where are you? And sometime in October saying, okay, I'm finally going to go home, I guess. But if you're there at least a day ahead of time, we go out early. But it's like 7 hours, but we leave early because it is the desert in August. But look that up if you're interested. But it gives you a taste of what the big tour is like, and we'll do it again in 2018. We haven't decided what that'll be yet, but the San Francisco was definitely fun, and it was awesome to have that bonus 50th anniversary and have everybody, that just general 5-0 fever excitement permeated the tour, and it was great.
I think next time you should add a Miles O'Brien component where you just eat food rations, like Starfleet rations throughout the day instead of, you know, stopping at diners or restaurants.
Right. And somebody walks in every day in some alien garb and beats you up or whatever. Yeah.
All right. So that's geeknationtours.com if anyone's interested. One thing I want to mention that we did here on the network, and again, I missed participating in almost all of it because of work initially, and then all my eye surgery and hospitalizations after that. And that's From There to Here. From There to Here is a special show that we did last year. We published one episode every single day for 366 days. We never missed a day. This is a project that was created and produced and spearheaded by Mike Schindler from Stage 9, previously Commentary Trek Stars. But it was a huge collaborative effort because hosts from all around the network, all the shows on the network, as well as recurring guests came in. We had all kinds of interesting combinations, and many, many different people were involved in editing these shows. So it was a collaborative effort. And the fact that we were able to pull it off and publish a new episode every day for 366 consecutive days was quite an accomplishment. So I want to thank everyone on the network who pulled that off. And of course, everyone who listened and supported it. We went through on the timeline. We started with Enterprise, and the first episode is like a mission briefing. And then the second episode is the first one where we talk about an episode of Star Trek, and that's Broken Bow and Fight or Flight. And then we ended with Beyond and a little recap closing right there in the final episode. So if anyone wants to check that out, from there to here, you can find it on the website or go to iTunes and subscribe to it, or Apple Podcasts, I should say, these days.
Yes, it was an amazing accomplishment, Chris. I had nothing to do with any of them, but still it was an amazing accomplishment, and a lot of people involved. And just your regularity of being daily for 366, producing that was amazing.
That is way, way harder to pull off than anyone can imagine. It sounds difficult, but to do it really did require a collaborative effort. I don't think that even a small group of us, like four or five of us, I don't think it would have been possible to pull that off. So that was impressive because, again, it's not the only show we're doing, right? That's a special show in the midst of all the other shows we have here on the network. Another thing that came out, and I haven't seen this yet, Larry. I've been thinking about ordering it from Amazon in the U.S. for quite a while. The Roddenberry Vault came out, and it's very affordable in the U.S., but it's like equivalent of about $80 or so from Amazon in Japan, so I haven't purchased it yet, but I will soon because I'm actually going to watch it and do my own coverage of it. But you have more to say about it, so share your thoughts on this unique project that Rod and Roddenberry Entertainment did for the 50th.
Oh, it's just amazing. Mike and Denise Okuda and Roger Lay, who's been directing and producing the recent the last generation of Star Trek documentaries across the board, who has been good enough to have me in on screen among the talkers for a lot of that, did an amazing job. And I knew for the last 8 or 10 years, Roddenberry has inherited the family archives, and there's so many little clips and oddball bits and pieces. You know, what's funny is for years, Lincoln Enterprises, now it's this big thing to fans, but if you were a first-generation fan, one of the ways that, you know, Gene and Majel survived in the 70s was having Lincoln Enterprises, which is now Roddenberry.com. And if it was flat and would mail, then they would sell it. And they would cut unused film strips into clips of 3 frames. And some they would be grab bags, and some would be sorted. Like you could get a Kirk bag or a tin in a bag or something or whatever, and Spock, or you could get ships, or you could get aliens, or you know, sets or whatever. And people collected those. And the only way in the area before not just digital and frame grabs and the internet, but before VHS tapes, and you could pause something even for a bad shaky pause picture, was people would get those clips and the high end ones. And I collected them. I either had McCoy looks or graphics, you know, and oh, here's the neutral zone map from Balance of Terror. Oh, look in detail. Here's the atmospheric pressure gauge dial outside, you know, the hangar deck. Those were like gem clips and, you know, oddball angles of props. And so that's the way anybody who did costumes and props, those are your prized possessions. And there was even a zine dedicated to collectors. It was called the Clipper Ship for frame clip, you know, collectors. Anyway, that was the whole thing. And that film that existed, apparently, I had always thought they must have just about sold it all over the years, but apparently they didn't. They kept some goodies back. And the vault, the guts of the vault, which is very cool, is a few deleted scenes, which were amazing, that I'd seen some clips from before. Kirk's nephew, Peter. There was a scene at the end of Operation Annihilate where Peter comes out in a little miniature captain's outfit and Kirk lets him sit in the chair. There's a conversation. That got cut. And a few alternate scenes and takes. But there are so many little bits and pieces and alternate takes that weren't used in shows, and a few bits and pieces of when the camera would start up and you'd catch the director on set talking. And I'm not doing this justice at all. I did an interview with Mike and Denise and Roger, and I've only put up the first part of it back when it came out last fall. Even the packaging is cool. It actually feels like a vault when you open it up. And they recently won an award, a trade award, along with the big 50th anniversary, everything, all Kirk missions in one box. That big, huge thing. Both won awards, and so congratulations to all their team.
Yeah, that was an amazing package they put together. The one you're talking
about,
right?
The big black one, which is amazing. But the big set. But of the vault, it is amazing. And they included about 8 or 10 episodes, of the enhanced versions for comparison. So you had it right there in the disc. It was a 3-disc set, just a ton of incredible behind the scenes things. Mike and Denise were talking about how they had started years ago, and it's in my video interview, logging all of this through several different people helping and assisting over the years, and not even knowing what they would do with it as they went through logging what Rod had gotten into. Here's what's in the cans, and people didn't know. And the whole discovery of looking in this can and having it be a label, and what does that label mean? Is that really what's in here? And oh my God, here's an alternate take of Spock's mind meld with Sargon. Or here's an alternate angle of Kirk's risk is our business speech from that same episode. So there were just so many gems. And if you're a fan, oh, and visual effects footage. The full you've seen the pictures for years, even in color, of the guy at the original effects house, with the giant 11-foot Enterprise on the crane and the camera dollying around it the way they used to have to shoot the effects footage, and some of the takes that didn't make it because you get to the end and the ship would wobble or the camera would wobble and it would ruin the whole thing, and some alternate outtakes of that and angles that you'd never seen before and some close-up looks at some of the models that way. There's a ton on there. And again, it's 3 discs and a lot of new commentary from a lot of creative voices. And they've gotten a lot of new faces and they've gotten a lot of celebrity Trek fans in. So it was great to see all those people involved. It sold out when it went on sale. Amazon, it sold out in 3 or 4 days. I forget what it was. And they had to restock. Yeah. Which was amazing. Yeah. So yeah, it made a big splash, and there were some criticisms of it, like, why did you take all this room with these episodes we've already got before? Well, they're there for you to have an instant, you don't have to swap out discs and get at it. But that was way overshadowed by the amazingness and the fact that these things that had been in cans for 40 and 50 years, right, at the Roddenberry House.
That's what's really interesting.
Are seeing the light of day. And what was sad was, Mike and Denise, I don't think this is not, hype for a second when people are saying, we want more. And Mike is saying, that's kind of all there is, guys.
Well, this set, the Roddenberry Vault, won Best Extras, Best Bonus Materials at the 7th Annual Home Media Awards.
Thank you.
Which is, a testament to the kind of stuff that's on there. You mentioned the commentaries that haven't been seen before as well. That's why I buy sets in the first place, is to get that kind of extra content. And for those wondering, the one we were mentioning a moment ago where we're talking about the packaging and the whole set winning an award, that was also at the 7th Annual Home Media Awards. And that's the Star Trek 50th Anniversary TV and Movie Collection. It's the one in a black box, and it's got the TOS characters on the front, like they're beaming in. But it has all the discs for TOS and TAS, I believe.
Yes.
And the movies all together, and really nice art design as well. It's really beautiful.
If Kirk was the prime captain, it's in this box. That kind of got me. I was holding that box thinking, oh my God, because it's the original series, it's animated, and it's all the movies. The 6 movies. Yeah. And I thought, here it is. I'm holding all of that in one box. It's incredible.
Well, speaking of extras and learning things that happened in the past that we don't know about yet, that's something that you're dedicated to doing through Portal 47, which had a big surge in the 50th anniversary year. So I know people who listen to the network, they've heard you talk about Portal 47, but tell me, the 50th year was good to you, right?
Yes. Thank you for mentioning that, Chris. No, it's Portal 47 is continuing to build. I've just announced and am working on the kind of the premium level of Portal 47, which is called Deck 1. And I invite anybody to get a hold of me if you're interested in that. It's a very small group. But the primary Portal 47, yeah, we had a big growth spurt last year, but it was just, I'm just amazed at, with the 50th coming for a few months, when we would have our telebriefing guests, I kind of focused more on the 50th, just being cognizant of history. Because, you know, that's been my soapbox for years, is getting people aware of that, just preserving and protecting, you know, documents and files and people, getting them on camera, getting them to talk, getting them at a convention. And part of Portal 47 is trying to find another way to do that faster, quicker, in more quantity, and more of a personal touch, right, for people. And we actually, a few months prior to the 50th, had found out that Bob Butler, who directed The Cage, of all things, you know, which was actually 52 years old, was out and talking at panels. And we, for the first anniversary of Portal, which was in just coincidence in September, so now it's kind of nice it's the same anniversary month as Star Trek, we had a first anniversary open house, and I invited the internet to come in, and we had a ton of people listening, and we had an hour with Bob Butler. So that was amazing. And then I'll say one more thing. On the actual September 8th, at first I didn't know. We had all the big, you know, Vegas and the New York Con was happening in a few weeks, and there was so much big stuff. And I just wanted to have a little celebration here locally. And we just, Lucy's El Adobe, which is a Mexican restaurant across the street on Melrose from Paramount, that has a big picture of Gene in the back autographed. After Nicodell's closed, it kind of became the watering hole over the years when that was an important thing. So John Champion, who Trek FM knows, obviously, from Mission Log, and I co-sponsored just a little local meetup for Angelinos and anybody passing through town. We just got together. I made a big 50th anniversary card. It's on my blog if you want to see. And we did some Facebook Live. Every hour, we figured out the hour, the starting time of Man Trap across the evening. And every hour we did a little Facebook Live. People had some folks from the show. David Gerald came by for a little bit. It was kind of on short notice, and a lot of people from the LA area who I'd never met before came by, just fans. It was a wonderful, little, simple, fun evening. Oh, Dave Rossi came by. I'm probably going to forget some people now. But anyway, it was just a wonderful, simple little way. And so many people around the country were having viewing parties. You know, it was just our way of joining in. And we were in public as opposed to being at a private party. But it was just a wonder. We probably had 30, 40 people there through the night. So it was just perfect. It was just one of many around the world, you know, celebrating the 50th. After all the big hoo-ha and the big events and the big splash, it was just everybody celebrating in their own way. And it was just what we came up with to do it in our own little way here locally here in LA. And I will always remember that fondly. You know, like, where were you for the 50th, Daddy?
Yeah.
Or whatever. And yeah, so that was part of it. But again, Portal 47 is going great. So everybody's heard that portal47.net. Get a hold of me if you want to do that. We're growing, and I'm just very proud of that, and proud that some of these folks, there are still people who worked on the original series who are out there we've had as guests. So that's amazing in itself. And to have that first name, being able to hear them talk about, oh, Gene did this and Bill did this and Bob said that. And Dorothy said, well, Dorothy's still with us. And that was great to have her out at so many cons and so many people from the first generation.
Yeah. Well, it's good it's going so well, because I remember when you were planning it before it was ever launched. And, you know, we talked about the ideas for a long time, and it's come together and it's been successful. So
yes,
I'm glad to see that. We're going to close out here with a final point. I want to go back to the packaging that we were just talking about, because this is not to discuss the packaging, but to ask you a question. One thing that we've seen towards the end of last year and into the start of this year is CBS repackaging the different series. They're putting them into these complete series sets, which are very, very affordable. They're like, I mean, you can get them for like $80 for all of Deep Space Nine or all of Voyager.
The whole series, you know, right.
On my shelf over here to my right, I have every DVD set of every Star Trek series, but I bought them individually. So you can imagine how much that cost over time. And so now you can get them for the less than the price of one season. Previously, you can get the entire series.
Right, right.
But a lot of fans, when they see this, they think, well, CBS, they just keep rehashing everything. You know, I've already got it on DVD, and I can watch it on Netflix. I can stream it. It's going to be on CBS All Access, or maybe it already is. We don't have that here in Japan. Why would I want to buy this stuff? And I wonder if the question is less about repackaging this stuff for the fans, but rather making Star Trek more accessible to new fans and to the general audience. How do you see this? What do you think the strategy is here? Is it just to see if they can make more money?
Well, I mean, that's an interest, because we know that if they can't make money, which it's a company, they need to. But
right,
they don't, and they don't want to lose money.
Which is what we always say.
Right, right.
Yeah, exactly.
And obviously, the clamor to Blu-ray and up-res DS9 and Voyager, which has been, you know, sought for years, the conventional yeah. wisdom and the projections are that with the latter seasons of the Next Generation set did not sell up to expectations when they were doing seasons. So they don't think the cost it's going to have to go into DS9 and Voyager to do. So yeah, money has to play a part of it. We live in the real world. But having said that, I think I was kidding earlier about fighting the next war the way you ended the last one, you know, and the way fans look at new series. I think what the 50th also did to me is I've really tried to remember about not getting into a rut and not having my blinders on. I always try to stay, and sometimes it gets the better of me, like anybody, but I always try to be aware of how every so many years go by, the new technologies, the new platforms, the new media, new fans, you know, the J.J. Kelvin era movie fans, the fans who have come to Star Trek through streaming and through Netflix and all that access, their experience is different than all of us who have been around for wherever we came in, right? And we sometimes get into a rut. We have blinders on about thinking that the way we perceive all this is the way everybody does.
Right, exactly.
Even adjusting for era. So yes, I'm constantly trying to remember. Sometimes I have to, you know, have it thrown in my face in a good way. Because if you don't experience it, you don't experience it. But you're talking about repackaging these. The good thing about being, you know, the sad thing about not being profits nonlinear here is that once the investment is made, like with the season sets of all the series, now packaging them as one box, the whole show, is the whole series is now in one box, that's going to be cheaper. Given what it is, depending on the series, there is a nod toward doing some new background, some new event packaging, some, you know, value-added material, some VAM, bonus features, depending on what the series is. But there is a benefit to them being, they take up less space on your shelf. And I mean, obviously, if you remember it emotionally, what a drain it was, but you were going to be a fan and you were going to support and you wanted your own copies and you bought Voyager year by year. And now to see it in a box set at cheaper, like you said, cheaper than what one of those used to cost at the beginning. That can be a little disheartening, but maybe the sting of that goes away after a few years, or maybe after a year or two and you see it on sale, you know, wherever you can buy it on sale. Yeah. But you're not the only fan in the world. And thank God, I mean, if this wasn't a phenomenon happening where new people are coming to Star Trek all the time, no matter what the pipe, whatever the entry, you know, I used to kid about the JJ movies being the best gateway drug Star Trek ever had, and they go on to the harder stuff. Whatever the pipeline was, the fact that we have people rediscovering Star Trek is actually keeping it alive for all of us, that this hasn't dwindled away, and that we are still running around clutching our two-episode-at-a-time VHS tapes, and that's our only contact with the past.
That we recorded off of television.
Right, right,
and we
right.
paused to get the commercials out.
Yes, which I did. And even Netflix and the streaming services, those aren't forever, right? Contracts come, contracts right. go. The electromagnetic pulse made... No, I'm hopefully not... That won't happen.
Might happen here in Tokyo, but...
Right, yeah. right, right. But I mean, you know, having it... You know, they say that's great to depend on streaming. But, you know, folks, if something is really, really precious to you, get it in hard media.
Yeah.
And that's no guarantee, because in another 10 years, we'll have holographic, you know, purple rays or whatever. And we'll have to do that, too, to keep up. That's just the march of time. But... they're done. And you know, Roger and that team of the documentary bonus material folks did get a chance to retouch several of these and do some new material for that. So It is you. It's people that never bought it the first time around. There are some people who don't buy it because they're waiting for it to get cheaper and they just put up with it for years.
Because it's too expensive. I mean, the original sets were just too expensive.
Right. But your point is, and every time these are sold and promoted, we don't think about this level. But that's another boost in the mainstream. That's another boost to appealing
it gets
and finding
Star Trek back into the news, back into the mainstream
it's
media.
It's back in the mainstream spotlight, exactly. And the 50th, it was just a good year to pile on, right? With all the events and all the material that was out there and all the product. And look, we're getting ready to have, rumors aside, Discovery will come out. There will be a whole other Discovery wave effect with Discovery and people wanting to see, well, what else is, you know, maybe even people who were too young for the Kelvin movies, you know, and whether we had this talk lately about whether there'll be a fourth movie or not.
Larry, that's really scary to hear you say people who were too young for the Kelvin movies, like 2009, but it's true, right?
Time marches on. It catches up with
us. Time marches on.
Yes.
Yeah.
Stardate or otherwise. Right.
All right. Well, okay, so this was a good rundown of some of the things
of
that happened while I was away. It's not everything at all. In fact, we had some things on the outline which we just skipped over, and we could do a six-hour show probably, but I think 2 hours is going to be enough for everyone, so let's go ahead and wrap up.
Let the record show that I was not responsible for three-fourths of this podcast tonight.
That's true. All right, Larry, so we've talked about Portal 47. Which we always do. People go to portal47.net for that. Are you going to be appearing anywhere anytime soon?
Yes, we've got. SoonerCon back in Oklahoma in June, and that's June 23rd, 25th. Todd Habercorn is going to be a co-guest with me there, and there's a full lineup.
Okay, and of course, Todd plays Spock in Star Trek Continues for those who don't know.
And this comes from his big anime following too, and. Be doing something at San Diego Comic-Con, hopefully. I've got to get my panel idea in. I'm going to be at a new convention for me. It's a growing con here in Mid-State, California, Modesto Con, July 7th to July 9th, Modesto, California, up near Sacramento. And then we've got the one-day tour before Star Trek Las Vegas and Star Trek Las Vegas, obviously, in August. And I'm going to be doing a return, but different sites on the Michigan libraries again. If you're in central Michigan around the greater Detroit area, keep up with me and LarryNemechek.com and get the newsletter and check my calendar and we'll have that. And and some other things. My big time this year has been in we're making our push on, I know, don't faint, on The Con of Wrath, my documentary. We're actually starting to work on editing and getting that posted. And I'm working really hard on... I have actually been offline a little more, although I had a flurry of a lot of new videos recently. I mentioned the one with Reka and Mike Westmore's museum exhibit at his alma mater at University of California, Santa Barbara. So go to LarryNemechek.com. You can get to my blog and the videos and all of these things are there. But I've really been offline a little more than usual working on Portal 47 and working on The Con of Wrath. But then, of course, you've been off mic, Chris, so that may have had something to do with it.
That's true.
And hopefully media-wise, I have another something coming down the pike that I can't talk about until maybe midsummer or right before Vegas. So I'm hopefully looking forward to maybe talking about that too coming soon. But for right now, I've got plenty to do and hopefully people will find something fun to jump in with, like the way we do here. Background and canon and talking about connecting dots is what I do, so I invite everybody over at Larry Nemechek on Twitter and Larry Nemechek's Larry Nemechek's Trekland on Facebook.
Larry Nemechek Faceland.
Faceland.
Check that out.
Teenage Faceland. No, that's what Instagram is.
Now there's a new Trek FM ringtone right there, Larry.
That's what Snapchat is. Teenage Faceland.
All right. Well, it sounds like you're very busy, Larry, and hopefully I'm going to be back on mic more often, and you'll be back here with me as well.
You better.
Well, everyone, it's been a lot of fun talking about these things with Larry today, but this isn't the only thing we've been discussing on the network, so here's a quick look at some of the other things you may have missed elsewhere on Trek FM.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit.
Best of Both Worlds. It's a good episode. I enjoyed it. I remember when it first took off. Family was 100 times better to me. I'd watch Family 10 times to 1 over watching Best of Both Worlds or Inner Light. Those are the types of things that interest me. And I do enjoy the action-adventure pieces of it. I truly do. But I love seeing the characters, and that's why Wrath of Khan works.
Warp 5.
It was just mesmerizing to me. And I remember when my dad, a long time ago, had an airplane. He would take us up flying, but never, you know, would hold the wheel and say, hey, we're flying an airplane. But I never really was bitten by the flying bug. But it happened right there on a runway in Hawaii, on Oahu.
The 602 Club.
And we saw it in the first Alien as well. I mean, like, the company sent them to the planet to bring that alien back, right? And I didn't remember the part where, in this film, where Burke sent the colonists to go and find the ship on his own without authority from the company. I had forgotten that part. So that was kind of an interesting revelation, seeing this movie for the first time in 12 or 13 years, however long it's been since I've seen this.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Check out all of these shows and join the conversation about your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You'll find us everywhere you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button in Apple Podcasts on iPhone, iPad, or Apple TV, or the desktop iTunes app to get the latest episodes as soon as they are published. And please leave us a star rating and a written review. That helps us out, and we love to hear from you. If you're not an Apple user, we've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Google Play Music, Stitcher, TuneIn, Spreaker, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, in most third-party apps. And you can stream and download the MP3 file from our website or grab the RSS link. And this show, The Ready Room, is also available on Spotify. I'd love to hear your thoughts on the show today, and there are many ways for you to do that. The best place to join in the larger conversation is the Babel Conference. That's our listeners group on Facebook. Just type Babel, B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook, and it should come right on up. It is a closed group, so if you're not yet a member, you'll need to click join, but we'll let you in. And if you'd like to send us email, you can use the form on our website at trek.fm/contact. Choose to send to a show and select the Ready Room. That will come right to me. You can also find the network on Twitter. Our username there is TrekFM, and on Facebook at facebook.com/TrekFM. If you'd like to find me personally, you can find me on Twitter. My username is C. Brian Jones. That's letter C and Brian with a Y. You can also find me on Facebook with that same username, facebook.com/CBrianJones. And you can catch me there in the Babel Conference as well. You can also find my writing on the official website at StarTrek.com. And also here on the network, you can find me talking about Deep Space Nine with Matthew Rushing on The Orb. Now, just like The Ready Room, The Orb has been on a long break because of my eye surgery, but we're going to be recording new episodes soon, so I hope you'll join us there. I've been doing a bit of a rapid rewatch of Deep Space Nine. Not as rapid as I would like, but when I get moments, especially on the weekends, I'm watching, and I'm usually tweeting that. So follow me on Twitter if you want to find out some of my thoughts as I go back through. I'm actually I'm towards the end of season 2 right now, so I'll be starting season 3 very shortly. Beyond the world of Star Trek, I'm doing a new podcast for my work. I'm the editor-in-chief of The Journal, which is the magazine of the American Chamber of Commerce in Japan. That's my main job here in Tokyo. And the company I work for, who publishes this magazine, we also have a channel called BIJ TV, which is Business in Japan Television. And we've just started a podcast there. And I have a few episodes out. So if you're interested in hearing me talk about something other than Star Trek and learning a little bit about Japan at the same time, some of its business, some of its culture, the first episodes are actually more culture related. You can find that in iTunes or on Stitcher and in other places. BIJ.TV is the URL for the site as well as the name of the podcast. So check that out. Now, if you'd like to help us keep all of these shows coming to you each week, you can become a patron of the network on Patreon. Visit patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm to get all the details. Perks include early access to episodes, and we're getting a lot of those out recently, thanks to Brandon Shea Mutala, who is our new Patreon manager. He's doing a wonderful job of pushing out content ahead of schedule, something that I personally had trouble keeping up with. So thank you so much, Bichet, for that. You can also get exclusive content, producer credits, and more. And this is all available through our special patrons website, Patron Zone, which you get access to when you become a patron at the $5 per month level or higher. Now, you can also contribute less than $5 if you like, and there are a few perks there too. It requires a great deal of money to produce, host, and distribute these shows each month, a lot more than listeners realize. And so we really appreciate any support that you can give us, and I hope you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. Speaking of our patrons, I'd like to thank my associate producers here on The Ready Room: Renee Roberts, Zachary Fruling, Sam Piasek, Kay Elizabeth Shaw, Tim Robertson, and David Shuford. Thanks so much for your support of The Ready Room and sticking with me through this long absence. Okay, well, thanks again, everyone, for bearing with me here and listening to this new episode of The Ready Room, the first one in almost 9 months. And Larry, thank you for joining me on the mic as we do a special show to get me back into the flow of podcasting again. I was thinking, what am I going to do for the first show back? And I thought, well, I need to just get Larry on the mic because that's, you know, it's always fun for us to sit down and chat and sometimes record it for people to listen to.
That'll take 6 hours.
So thanks, Larry.
Thank you, Chris. It has been a long time. It's good to get back on with you in all this time. But you know what? It's time to stick a Klingon name apostrophe in it, because the Ready Room is done.